Good morning, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, I am representing the plaintiff appellant in this matter, Alan Paul, and although this is a cross appeal, I'm going to begin with a breach of contract first, since it had a certain amount of logic to that. It is our opinion that the contract which Mr. Paul signed with the defendant, the terms are unambiguous. And we say that because the plaintiff's version presents a certain, clear, and final interpretation, whereas the defendant's version is uncertain, unclear, and lack of finality. Because when you look at the contract, the plaintiff's version says that you must be severed within 2 years. And you know as of the two-year anniversary, if you are not severed, then you're going to remain a partner. Under the defendant's
Does that mean that on the last day of the two-year period, a meeting could be convened of the committee of six and your client brought in and the word given that you are terminated today? We'll sort out the severance package later.
No, because the contract required 30 days notice before the severance takes place. That's why, actually, he wasn't given notice until April 27th, or written notice until April 27th, and he was severed on May 27th, 30 days later.
So your position is that the contract requires termination in 1 year and 11 months,
or one year,
one year, 10 months, 29 right. days, whatever it works out. So
correct. If you look at paragraph 5B of the contract, it says you must be given 30 days notice of the severance date. So they have to decide and inform him, I would assume, of, you know, 1 year and 11 months before that two-year anniversary. And
but your position is the severance date has to be within the 2 years.
The severance must occur within the 2 years.
So once they got beyond April 1st, then they could no longer sever him under your...
I guess they could have notified him on April 5th that he was being severed on May 5th. The two-year anniversary, you know, I always said it was May 7th, and the court below said it was really May 6th.
All right, either date, but that's your point.
Yes.
Whether it's April 6th or April 7th, once they let that pass, they were obligated to compensate him for damages until he was 62.
There were other conditions subsequent after that two-year date that they could have invoked, but it's our position that the two-year termination is he became a partner on May 4th or 8th of 2002, and he would remain a partner until something after that terminated that relationship. And it's our position that the vote to remove him within the 2 years was a condition subsequent to the contract, which, as Williston states, ended the party's obligations.
But back to my hypothetical on the last day. Let's say they terminate him on the last day and say we're going to sort out what you get paid later. Your position is that the damages would be full payment to age 62 as opposed to the 30 days notice period.
If they said you are severed today, then the defendant's position that it's only a matter of notice might apply. But if they said to him on the last day, you're going to be severed in 30 days, we'd be in the same situation we are today. The severance must occur within 2 years.
Okay.
We believe it's unambiguous. And you can do that by looking within the four corners of the contract in question. First, as the court noted below, paragraph 5A uses very similar language. Your association with the firm will be deemed severed as of a date set by the board. And the language also, if you look in the paragraph 5, it refers to paragraph 7.03 of the partnership agreement. And it says, in addition to the terms in the partnership agreement. And if you look at the language of the partnership agreement, it uses very similar language, which are that you can be severed by a vote of the entire partnership and the entire voting interests on a date specified by the board. So the language used in paragraph 5B is similar to language elsewhere in the contract.
What's the precise point that you're appealing?
In the breach of the contract, we would ask that the lower court be affirmed on the breach of contract.
That's the argument you're making now.
Yes. The defendant has made a cross appeal. And for a point of logic, I started with that. We believe the court was absolutely correct in its interpretation below on the breach of contract claim. I do that not only because I believe the language is unambiguous, But if you believe it's not unambiguous, then you can use extrinsic evidence. And the extrinsic evidence is clear that he had to be severed within 2 years. There's this memorandum of understanding between Anderson and Deloitte, which says specifically that the severance could only take place within 2 years. The precise language was that it appears in the brief, states that for a period, in the memorandum of understanding, it says for a period of 2 years after the closing date, any selected tax member may be removed upon a majority vote of the committee. That's within 2 years. And you all can also look at the document that the defendant relied on below in the motion for summary judgment that was produced by Anderson at A51 of the brief that says, tells the Anderson partners before they go over, you can be severed within 2 years.
Now, by severed, is it your position that means more than just you're fired? That means you're fired, here's all the pay and everything you're entitled to receive, right, including your capital reimbursement, all of that has to happen within 2 years?
I don't think that they have to actually pay him within the 2 years, but the relationship would have to end within 2 years. As Mr. Wells, Deloitte's in-house attorney, testified, the date specified is the date the relationship ends. I would think there'd be no problem with paying him a week later or sending him the checks, but the relationship would end on the date specified. Turning to the damage part of this case, which is what we are appealing, we believe that the court erred by finding that Mr. Paul suffered no damages in this case. What the court really said in its closing, almost its closing remarks, said, if I don't hold this way, there's sort of a windfall here. And I think what the court did below was basically turn the law of damages on its ear. It seemed to adopt the defendant's point of view that, you know, we made a three-week mistake here. We shouldn't be held responsible for that. But the law of damages doesn't view the culpability of the wrongful act. It uses the consequences of the wrongful act. And to say I can't award damage here because I'm not really culpable, it's not a high degree of culpability, just turns the law of damages on its ear. You view the consequences of the wrongful act, not how wrongful the act is. And the defendant in this case does not dispute the measure of damages for a breach of an employment contract. They concede it's a difference between what would have been earned and what was earned, or what is being earned. That's conceded. Where the parties seem to separate is whether the contract was for a definite term or not. And it's our position the contract in this case was for a definite term. As the authorities say, and even as the courts have held in Delaware, specifically in Staten versus Capital Broadcasting.
All right. Well, Mr. Aver, let's go back a moment before we go into damages. In response to Justice Richley's question, did I understand that if on April 27th in the letter they said, you're done today, goodbye, your position is they would have violated the 30-day notice and the measure of damages would have been 30 days? Or did I misunderstand your answer?
If they ended the relationship within the 2 years, they would have complied with the contract.
So, did you understand my question?
Frankly, Your Honor, I had not actually focused on that before. I would think someone could claim that since it's a contract of a definite term, and the cases that, such as River, which the defendant relied upon, where there's a violation of the notice provision, says since this is a employment of indefinite duration, the violation of the notice term is simply you're entitled to a little more time of payment. But since this is a contract of a definite duration, by giving inadequate notice, it's really a two-step procedure. You must give adequate notice, and then the severance must occur within 2 years. So as I think about it, I would say that by giving notice on the last day of the two-year period, that you have breached the contract. You didn't give adequate notice, and therefore, given the fact that it's a contract of definite duration, that you've breached the entire contract. And breaching the notice provision also would breach the contract just as much as severing him after the 2 years.
When you use the phrase definite term, do you mean that there were no circumstances under which your client could be terminated after the two-year period if he did not get notice that he was severed during the two-year period?
Assuming that that 2 years came and went, and he continues a partner. Under the memorandum of agreement between the partners, there are two circumstances which a partner can be, as I use the term, de-partnered. One is a provision which says if you commit a crime, you lose your CPA license, or in term of principles, your law license, you can be severed on a date set by the board. There's another, and I would maintain that that's a condition subsequent, just as much as the two-year provision is. The other means that they can be severed is by a vote of the entire, it's a two-part procedure. The board, well, actually three-part, the board first has to specify a date, and then the entire partnership, all 2,000 or 3,000 of the partners, must vote you out, plus a majority of the voting interest. It's really two steps. You have the one man, one vote for all the partners, and then you have a weighted voting because, as you may have seen, each partner has a certain number of units. It's sort of like the electoral or the or voting process. Each state has a certain weighted voting. So the part you have to be, not only have a majority of the partners voting you out, but a majority of the units voting must vote you out.
Now, so must there be cause for that to happen?
Probably not. I have not examined the contract that closely. But that, again, is a fitting the definition of a condition subsequent. That, again, is a condition subsequent to the formation of the contractual relationship. As Wilson defines a condition subsequent, it's any act which ends the relationship. Well, and forgives the parties of their obligations under the agreement.
Given that there could be a turn of events after the two-year period that could result in severing him, or sounds brutal, let's just say terminating him.
The contract uses the term sever.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting terminology. But why wouldn't that make his damages speculative? Because it's dependent on what might happen in the future, that he continue his employment.
No, Your Honor, because once he is severed, as he has been in this case, he's no longer subject to that provision. You can't apply that provision in the memorandum.
But your position is the severance is void because it's contrary to the contract.
It's not that it's void. It's they breached the contract. He can't complain now he's a partner. He can't go into chancery and ask to be reinstated as a partner because money damages are adequate.
I follow you.
If you turn to damages, then we believe that this is a contract of definite duration, as the authorities state that you don't have to have a contract of definite duration as opposed to a contract for employment at will. You don't have to have a precise date stated. You can have, as long as it's capable of being calculated, and even if it can be implied, it's considered a contract of definite duration. And we believe that by the terms of the memorandum agreement, he would remain a partner until age of 62. And I demonstrated in my brief how that is calculated. It's on the year that he turns 62, the last day of that physical year is when he must retire. And I actually calculated the date. That would be make it a contract or provide that he remain a partner for a definite term.
And what's your view with regard to the significance, if any, of the facts that he accepted the few weeks' pay, he accepted the return of his capital contribution of $675,000 or something like that, and that he accepted the severance package. The arguments made that to the extent he accepted the pay, the severance package, and the return of his capital contribution, he acknowledged that they had complied with the contract.
That's basically the defendant's waiver argument.
Right.
And first of all, the capital was his money. That was money that he put in. And under the partnership agreement, it must be returned to him once the relationship is severed. Under the compensation provisions, the memorandum of understanding, not the partnership agreement, but the memorandum of understanding between Anderson and Deloitte provided that that had to be paid. So I argue that he's a third-party beneficiary of that. To the extent the defendant is making a waiver argument, as I point out in my brief, I believe they've waived that argument. One, it's an affirmative defense under the Superior Court rules, which was never pled, and the word waiver was never mentioned in the court below, either in the brief, in the motion papers, or at oral argument. And to the extent that the defendant points to this language, it's interesting because he argues in the briefs in this court that Mr. Paul waived the breach of the contract. But the language he points to was never raised in the breach of contract summary motion. It was raised in the damages motion after the court had already ruled that there was a breach of contract. So he never raised it for the point in the court below that he's using it here, even if you accept that that language is somehow a waiver argument. I see that I'm running into my rebuttal time. And
you want to save your time?
Yes.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court, the crucial facts in this case are undisputed. The two-year period expired on May 7th. Mr. Paul knew he'd been severed in early April of 2004, and for the rest of April, he was actually discussing with Deloitte the possibility of his voluntarily resigning.
What's early April? What's the date?
Well, the decision was made on April 12th. Mr. Aber indicated during a deposition that Mr. Paul had learned in early April. That's the best I can tell you.
It appeared someone thought April 7th might be significant. I just wondered if it was on or around April 7th.
I honestly can't say. I will refer you to Mr. Paul's memorandum. He wrote himself a memo in which he talks about being told by Deloitte that they were recommending a termination, but the actual decision of the Committee of Six didn't take place till the 12th of April. As I say, he was already negotiating in April about resigning in return for an increased severance payment. When he rejected that offer that Deloitte made about signing a release in return for an increased severance payment, Deloitte gave him a written notice that he was severed and that his last day would be May 27th. Mr. Paul says he got that notice on April 27th. It was dated April 22nd, but it was, all within the two-year period. His partnership ended 3 weeks after May 7th, and he was fully compensated for those 3 weeks. And when, as we've already talked about, when the partnership ended, he was compensated with a significant severance payment, his return of capital, which Mr. Aber talks about, this memorandum of understanding. Those aren't binding. Those are guidelines.
So the severance payment was over $200,000, which represented 4 months' pay, something like that?
Something like that. And, of course, he was paid for the three extra weeks as well. He was compensated. So all of that was done. And
could that letter have been written in a way that said you're severed effective 5 years from now? And would that be a violation of the contract?
I believe it would. I think what I'm saying here is that there were no damages as a result of the assuming that there was a late severance. 3 weeks late, he was paid for the 3 weeks. He was provided all his compensation. On May 11th, he'd already gotten a job offer from another accounting firm that he joined shortly after the severance took place. Now, so it seems to me there was no damages. Now, if you're arguing 5 years later, that sort of cuts a little both ways. I mean, first of all, that's an awfully long time. But second of all, if he got paid for all of those 5 years and, hung around and didn't do anything, then, maybe that's a good thing for him. And he could have quit at any time.
So I understand your position.
Right.
A letter saying that you are terminated effective 5 years from now would be a breach of contract by Deloitte.
I think it would be.
Right. So why isn't a letter saying you're severed 3 weeks?
Two reasons. Because from the beginning, Deloitte understood that that's all they had to do, and there wasn't any violation of the language, and I'm going to talk about that in a little while. But second, because there were no damages as a result of this, even assuming, which we have to do for the moment, that there was a breach, Mr. Paul didn't sustain any damages as a result of it.
But your position is they had to give him notice within 2 years, and then if the notice was given within 2 years, and they then had to compensate him for 30 days.
Correct. Correct.
And that, and by giving the notice within the 2 years and providing 30 days compensation, they complied with the contract in all respects, and that's your cross appeal, that the Superior Court was wrong on the first point.
That's right. You know, and another important point is that from the beginning, that was Deloitte's understanding. Mr. Wells' testimony indicates that what you had to do during the two-year period was give the notice, and then after that, the admission agreement, and it wasn't the understanding, memorandum of understanding, it's the admission agreement that covered this, and at that point, it triggered certain payments.
So you differ from Mr. Aber in, to the extent that he said you have to give notice on April 7th,
absolutely.
April 5th, and your position is as long as you give notice up until the last day of the 2 years and then provide 30 days compensation after that, you've complied.
Yes, and in fact, let me, and just to confirm that that was Deloitte's understanding all along, at page B364 of the appendix, Steve Severin, who is the partner who was in charge of so-called partner matters, he says in a note, internal note, before any of this happened, quote, I assume as a last resort we can send a T-mail, in other words, a termination notice, on May 6th. So that was their all along. Their understanding was what they did. They gave the notice, and then after that, everything followed.
So how did the Superior Court reach a contrary result?
Well, according to the court, what the court said, they said that they, the judge really said he, for a while he was confused, but he finally decided that it was clear and that everything had to be done by then. Now, my interpretation, which we've set out in the briefs, of the language is that all that had to be done was the specification of the date. And I tried to go into a little bit of grammatical detail on that point, but you know that it is what it is, and we just think that the result was a wrong result.
Is this a litigant-specific issue that we're being asked to resolve, or does it have ramifications for other contracts coming out of the same milieu?
I don't think so. I think this is simply one of those factual situations that, you know, results in one determination based on what happened in this case. As I say, Mr. Paul knew all along that he had been severed, and that's the issue. And I'm going to talk about a little bit about cases that are a little bit different than that Mr. Aber relies upon. But I want to first talk just briefly about the damages cases, the breach of contract cases. When they talk about damages, they say you look at what happened and you compare it to what would have happened if supposedly proper procedures had been followed, if Mr. Paul had given his notice, had gotten his notice on April 7th or sometime before. And the answer is there are no damages. Mr. Paul was paid. The only difference would be that if proper procedures had been followed, he would have been severed earlier and have gotten less compensation.
Looking at it as a notice violation, and that if you gave the notice late but you got the full 30 days compensation, you have no damages. Mr. Aber's saying if the notice is late, you've triggered damages through age 62.
And I submit that's a hyper-technical interpretation that rules out any considerations of fairness and reasonableness. And let me illustrate it by a case that Mr. Aber cited, the Fidelity National case, which is at page 22 of his answering brief. That was a case involving a partnership in which there was a provision that said if a partner wants to assign his share, there has to be notice. And what happened there was if the notice triggered a long process, a right of first refusal process took place where there were two appraisers first appointed, one by each side. Those two had to select a third appraiser, and then each appraiser separately had to value the partnership. And according to the time limits in this notice provision, it could take as long as 6 months. So the Fidelity case, which, as I say, Mr. Aber cites in favor of his position, they held the way that they did because the language that required a whole series of actions, not just a notice and end of process, number one. And number two, in that case, the court said everybody understood the language. And here, there's a dispute about that. But what I would like to do is to direct your honors to cases that were cited and distinguished in the case of the Fidelity case. It's appendix page C-173, where the court, that's the decision in the Fidelity case, and there's three cases. One is a case called Campbell versus Cook County Sheriff's Merit Board. In that case, a public employee claimed that even though he had been given oral notice, he didn't get a written notice of his hearing, and therefore the fact that he was terminated should be overturned. And the court said no, because there was substantial compliance, because he knew he was going to have this hearing. Another case called Rogers versus Bowsley that they cite, breach of a real estate contract. And instead of sending notice to the seller, as they were supposed to, they sent the notice to the seller's attorney, and the seller was aware of it. Again, they said substantial compliance. And finally, in a case even more similar to ours, in my opinion, Loaf versus Meyer, there was a real estate contract that said you had to give a written notice of any construction on a certain property. And no written notice was sent in that case, but the seller was living on the property, saw the construction, and didn't say anything about it. And again, they said that's substantial compliance. And the Fidelity Court said that those facts are different from the Fidelity case because, quote, the potential for prejudice in those cases from receiving improper notice is not equivalent to that presented by the facts of this case. And none of the cases relied upon, those three cases, did the receipt of written notice begin the time-oriented process of valuing the interests and exercising the right of first refusal. It is this process and the potential for prejudice resulting from the lack of written notice that distinguishes this case. It seems to me that our case is like the three cases that they distinguished. It's not like the Fidelity case. There wasn't any elaborate process that took place. There was simply a severance and a notice. Mr. Paul knew he'd been severed. He wasn't harmed by waiting three more weeks for the actual partnership to end. As I think has already been mentioned, the fact that Mr. Paul kept the money that he was paid, and that was money that was only payable at the end of a partnership, is significant. And he didn't say anything about it. Mr. Aber says that we waived the issue, and that brings me to the waiver argument. We did raise the issue in the court below, and it's true. It was raised in the damages part. Mr. Aber responded at that time, but most important, what Judge Hurley he said at that time. He said, and it's page 8236, page 24 of the transcript, he doesn't have to reach that issue. He said he was resolving the case without reaching the issue of waiver, without reaching the issue of whether or not Mr. Paul had given notice to Deloitte by supplying them with information. In this court, Mr. Aber has briefed the issue completely, and he really hasn't supplied any logical, justifiable reasons why waiver shouldn't apply in this case.
Well, he cites the Superior Court rules that says it has to be affirmatively pled, and it was not, apparently, the answer was not amended.
No, it was not affirmatively pled. That's true. That's true. But okay. I that's not a rigid rule. I think that in cases where there's been no actual harm, courts have applied the rule that waiver is appropriately used. So it's not absolutely certain. The cases Mr. Waver cites on the waiver issue, one involved res judicata, so it's just not the same. Another case, and in fact the one case another case he says called Johnson versus Cullen actually supports our position, and this is sort of what I was saying, Justice Ridgely. If the defendant, in that case, they say, if the defendants raise, quote, the issue at a pragmatically sufficient time, unquote, and the plaintiffs were not prejudiced in their ability to respond, there is no waiver. And that's our case. It was raised in the Superior Court. Judge Hurley, he said wasn't reaching it. In this case, it's been fully briefed, so there's been no harm. Mr. Paul wasn't disadvantaged in the court below because the issue was not resolved at that time. And it's been fully briefed before your honors. So it seems to me that under those circumstances, we haven't waived it, and he has waived his right to bring the claim at all. Now, Mr. Aber also says that somehow Mr. Paul's status changed after the two-year period. But I'd refer your honors to the language of the partnership agreements, which specifically has an involuntary termination provision. And what takes the only thing that's changed is the decision makers making the decision. For 2 years, it's the committee of six. After that, it's the partnership that makes the decision. But there is still a situation here where it's indefinite. It's a without cause situation all along, and that's different than in the cases Mr. Abrash cited.
Although the process for that decision is far more complex, apparently.
That's true, but I mean, if we're talking about hyper-technical, you know, theories, then that really doesn't matter. The process doesn't matter. The fact that the language is in there and that the status was the same over time is what matters, I would submit. I mean, if we're talking about fairness, then that's another story, and it seems to me that fairness greatly favors us because Mr. Paul was not harmed by the fact that he was paid for 3 more weeks after the severance notice was given. I said this a little bit before, but the memorandum of understanding was not a binding contract. I just want to emphasize that Mr. Avery is saying that Mr. Paul's rights didn't come from the admission agreement, but it came from the memorandum of understanding. But those were guidelines; those were not binding. So what really was binding was what ended up in the language of the contract. And there's another case which is at page 33 of Mr. Abrash's brief called the Christofek case, which he tries to distinguish. And I just want to read you that language. It says, conditioning employment until the employee decides to retire is nothing more or less than conditioning employment upon the will of the employee. That is to say, employment until retirement is indefinite employment. And Your Honor's talked a little bit about that, and I think that's what the case is. This is an indefinite status situation all along. Let me turn to the cross appeal. Mr. Paul says that the words in the admission agreement should be moved around, according to him, so that it reads that he had to be severed by, quote, a date within 2 years that was specified by a committee. But that's not what it says. The participial phrase in 5B of the admission agreement says the date had to be specified within 2 years by the committee. I submit that that's clear, and that the severance date itself didn't have to be within 2 years. It simply had to be specified within 2 years. And, you know, interpreting language, context is everything. And in the cases Mr. Abrash cited, The word specified was not used in conjunction with a time period.
You agree, though, that this all of this language was drafted by your client?
It was drafted by Deloitte, by my client. And as I mentioned in the briefs, Mr. Paul negotiated for an increase in his number of units. And, you know, there's no question that there was a negotiation going on. So that he's a sophisticated guy. He's negotiating one thing. He could have negotiated anything he wanted to, at least raise the issue, and he had other offers at the time. So if he didn't like the language here, he could have gone somewhere else. So this is not a situation where contra proferentum should apply. If, you know, I assume that's the issue.
Well, the Chief Justice asked about the implications of this for cases generally. Mm-hmm. Putting aside generally, how about within the subset of Deloitte? Did all of these Arthur Anderson people come over at the same time so that we have a lot of these two-year terminations that might be coming in the future?
No. The two-year period has expired. There's nobody else out there. It's only Mr. Paul.
Well, there are others who are out there who have that potentially a stake in whether this is indefinite or not, right?
Sure. I mean, any partner at Deloitte, but I mean, you can read the language, and it is indefinite. I mean, anybody can involuntarily severed without cause. Specifically, it says that in the partnership agreement.
Well, so my question is, are there people who have been terminated, you know, without in a similar circumstance?
Yeah.
That are waiting to find out if they can get the same damages as Mr. Paul, or are there, have the 2 years run with regard to everyone who might be eligible for applying this precedent, and to the extent they haven't filed a claim, they can no longer file a claim?
That's correct. No claims were filed other than by Mr. Paul after the 2 years expired, as I understand it. I'm not aware of, and I can represent, there at this point, this is the only case that involves that two-year situation involving the Arthur Anderson people. In section, well, my time's expiring, so I guess I should stop. I was going to talk a little bit about the difference between, you know, the language of 5B and the language of the other provisions. But basically, I think it's clear that the word specified used in conjunction with a date, as it was here, means that it's only the date that has to be specified within 2 years. And in other situations, it means something else.
Thank
you. So you look at the language. Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, I'd like to address very quickly the claim by Deloitte that there is no damage suffered by Mr. Paul. The court below accepted the, as they call it, the Hornbook rule, that the measure of damages are determined from the party's point of view at the time the contract is formed. At the time this contract was formed, Mr. Paul had two expectations. Either he would be severed prior to the two-year anniversary, that means the relationship would have ended, or if it had not been ended on that two-year anniversary, he could remain a partner subject to the partnership agreement. The court said, well, once you got told that you were going to be severed after the two-year period, your expectations would have had to have been changed or met. And those were, he never had an expectation that he could be severed after the two-year period under the contract we're talking about. In essence, the notice that Deloitte gave Mr. Paul was, you're going to be severed, but we're going to breach the contract when we do it. All he got was notice that the contract was going to be breached. And he didn't get notice that he was going to be severed under the terms of the contract.
But he got notice that he was going to be severed as of a date certain, even though that date certain was outside the two-year period.
Yes, and that by severing him outside the two-year period, Deloitte breached the contract.
Well, I understand that's your argument, but I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but the question of when he found out that he was going to be severed was answered within the two-year period.
It was told to him within the two-year period. But the contract required the severance to occur prior to May 6th or May 7th.
I understand that's your position.
To the extent that the language of the contract is confusing, the law of Delaware is clear that Deloitte, as Mr. Sandler admitted, drafted this language. It was incumbent upon Deloitte as the dominant party to make sure that language was clear. Mr. Paul did not negotiate any of the language in the contract. To the extent that there was any negotiation as to the number of units that he got, and the units that he negotiated for were those that had been taken away from him. If you look at page C39 of our answering brief appendix, that's the internal document for Deloitte, which sets out the terms of his mission. And it says the number of units that he got was per the memorandum of understanding between Anderson and Deloitte. It doesn't say he got the number of units that was negotiated, because the memorandum of understanding had a formula which calculated it was a certain percentage of your income at Anderson is what you were supposed to get at Deloitte. With regard to the argument of waiver, Deloitte tries to pass that off saying we argued it below and there's no prejudice. The problem is if it had been pled as an affirmative defense or at least mentioned somewhere before we got to the motion for summary judgment, it could have been explored in depositions or in discovery. We never got a chance to explore that. I never got a chance to ask Mr. Paul if he intended a waiver. I never got a chance to ask any of the Deloitte representatives, did you consider this a waiver? And why did you consider it a waiver?
Your time's almost up. Could you comment on the document Mr. Sandler cites that's on B-364, which is this internal notation by someone at Deloitte that said and they thought they could give notice up until May the 6th?
Well, that's their perhaps that's Mr. Severin's interpretation. I don't have that document right in front of me. But what they thought, obviously, they thought they could notify him before and sever him after. And that's part of the crux of the breach of contract. The language of the contract and all its other provisions, language of the Memorandum of Understanding, language of the Anderson document, there's not one written document that suggests that they could sever after the 2 years, except for the internal communications between them. And to the extent that Mr. Severn thought that, he was getting bad legal advice.
So, or stated differently, to the extent they thought they wrote the sentence that way in the contract, your view is they didn't accomplish what they thought they did.
No, because if you understand how it happened, I think I pointed this out in my brief, they took the language from the partnership agreement, which says you can be severed on a date specified by the board, and slipped into it, in the middle of it, within 2 years. This wasn't carefully thought out, drafted language. It's more of a cut and paste. And they just slipped in that within 2 years in the middle of the sentence they had in the partnership agreement.
I have just one last question. Is it fair to assume from the argument we just heard that there's no contention over whether or not there's a breach of an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
We did argue. That was a pled thing. And when the court ruled on the argument.
Is it currently in play or not?
It's not in play because the court entered it as a final judgment.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.